For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
The talk I'm going to give tonight, I'm actually going to change the title, which I think is very uncommon. but it came about by a question, and there was a gentleman, I remember he was sitting in that chair last year on a Sunday, and after Tygon had given a Dharma talk, he asked a really important question, and it was, I'm going through a really, really tough time, and how can that help? And that is, I think that's where a lot of us are coming from and come to Zen with, is this idea that, yes, we are suffering, and I mean, ultimately, I think Zen is about helping others. But I think that's a really good starting point, because we aren't allowed to help others when we're kind of caught up in our own suffering. And so in thinking about that, I guess my title of the talk would be, how do we practice during tough times? I'm going to start out giving kind of some theories, talk to the experts, and then maybe give you some ideas that I have experienced in my practice, and then hopefully you guys can give me, and I'm sure you will, give me some great ideas. But there is this idea that this metaphor of the razor's edge, and I read this book a long time ago, and this metaphor has really stuck with me. This is Everyday Zen by Charlotte Jokelbeck. And I'm just going to read a little bit about it and talk about it. She says, "Now what do I mean by the razor's edge? What we have to do to join together these seemingly separate divisions of life is to walk the razor's edge. Then they come together. But what is the razor's edge? Practice is about understanding the razor's edge and how to work with it. Always we have an illusion of being separate, which we have created. When we're threatened or when life doesn't please us, we start worrying, we start thinking about a possible solution. And without exception, there is no person who doesn't do this. We dislike being with life as it is because that can include suffering, and that is not acceptable to us. Whether it's a serious illness or a minor criticism or being lonely or disappointed, that is not acceptable to us. We have no intention of putting up with that, or just being that, if we can possibly avoid it. We want to fix the problem, solve it, get rid of it. That is when we need to understand the practice of walking the razor's edge. The point at which we need to understand it is whenever we become upset." So then she goes on to say, "First, we need to know we're upset. Many people don't even know this when it happens. So step number one, be aware that upset is taking place. When we do Zazen and begin to know our minds and our reactions, we begin to be aware that, yes, we are upset. That's the first step, but that is not the razor's edge. We're still separate, but now we know it. How do we bring our separated life together? To walk the razor's edge is to do that. We have once again to be what we basically are, which is seeing, touching, hearing, smelling. We have to experience whatever our life is right this second. If we're upset, we have to experience being upset. If we're frightened, we have to experience being frightened. And if we're jealous, we have to experience being jealous. And such experiencing is physical. It has nothing to do with the thoughts going on about the upset." And then a little bit later, she says, "In fact, the enlightened life is simply being able to walk that edge all the time. And while I don't know anyone, and I would agree with her, who can always do this, certainly after years of practice, we can do it much of the time. It is a joy to walk that edge." So I read this quite some number of years ago in my practice, and it stuck with me for a long time. And I feel like you can use this metaphor in a lot of different ways. First of all, there is this idea of the razor, and there is an idea of, for me, that points to a danger. and it's not overwhelming danger, but there is a certain amount, it's right effort, it's a certain amount of energy that we bring to this practice, because yes, we are enlightened as we are right now, sitting on our mat, but at the same time, we suffer, and we deal with this monkey mind, and we need to bring some amount of effort to our lives. And the razor's edge, I feel like, is the point at which our identities meet up with our practice. And sometimes it's a really kind of tough struggle. Sometimes maybe it's a glancing blow. But that's an idea. Also, I think the razor's edge is just now, this moment, not the future, not the past. And there is just that sliver of the moment. And so I'm going to use this metaphor to kind of overlay into this idea of when our identities meet our practice. And the Roshi that I studied with in Denver used to call this the point of practice. So there is a moment when our stories of ourselves and our ideas of ourselves come to arise. And those can be big or they can be small, and sometimes it's real simple. For instance, you know, I've noticed a lot of times when I'm walking towards the train, and you can see it for about a mile, and you're always looking, oh, is that red line coming? Is it coming? Is it coming? And if it comes before I get there, if I'm not being aware, a lot of times I can go, oh, that was my train. And then you can kind of get lost in that idea. That's my train. My identity is that train. That's what train I was supposed to be on, and it can cause suffering. And it's not about pushing that away necessarily, I don't think either. But there is this idea of the awareness that we bring to it, I think, can kind of give it less power. And I'm going to give a couple more examples a little later of some, because that's not really a life crisis, and that's a helpful to be able to say, yes, that's not my train, because I'm not on it. but there are, I think that's the starting point to help us with maybe some bigger things. But I think the ultimate place we start is on our mat. And when we notice our thoughts come up, when we notice our feelings, when we notice the pain in our knee, we don't push it away. We don't grab onto it and say, ah, that's my knee, it's in pain. What we do is we shed awareness onto it, shed a light of awareness onto it. And that's the starting point. And it is a practice. It's not something for some monks up in the mountains to do. It's something that we can do right now. But it is a practice, and through that practice, just like the way I practice my trumpet, through that practice, there is a certain amount of ability that comes to it. In the same way that you really don't need it because we are enlightened, but there is a certain amount of it becomes easier and easier to find that light of awareness, I guess. Good way to say it. So along with this also, I wanted to read another book by Jo Kobeck, just a little spot. And she talks about this idea of our identities and the stories that we tell ourselves as a switchboard that you're plugging into. And she imagines it as this giant wall of switches. And since I'm kind of an audio engineer nerd, I imagine it as a giant soundboard that kind of plugging quarter-inch plugs into, and we're always, you know, turning up the volume here and different things. But she says, in ordinary life, we all carry around what we can all imagine, what we can call an imaginary baseboard. An electrical baseboard that jolts us whenever we encounter what feels like a problem. We can imagine it with millions of outlets all within our reach. Whenever we feel threatened or upset, we plug ourselves into it and react to that situation. The baseboard represents our fundamental decision about how we have to be in order to survive and get what we want in life. That's our identity, I feel like. As young children, we discover that life wasn't always the way we wanted to be, and things often went wrong from our personal point of view. We didn't want anyone to oppose us. We didn't want to experience unpleasantness. And so we created a defensive reaction to block the possible misery. That defensive reaction is our baseboard, or the stories we tell ourselves. We're always plugged into it, but we especially notice it at times of stress and threat. We have made a decision that ordinary life, life as it actually is unacceptable to us, and we try to counter what's happening. And then she goes on to say, the point of practice is to become friendly with the baseboard. We're not going to get rid of it all at once. We're too fond of it for that. But as the mind truly quiets and becomes less interested in fighting with the world, when we give up our position in some pointless battle, when we don't have to do all of that fighting because we come to see it for what it is, then our ability to just sit increases. And finally, she goes on to say, if we understand our practice over years of sitting, the baseboard becomes thinner and less dominating. So she noticed she didn't say that it goes away, which I think is important. It can lose some of its power. And I don't think that any of us will, and I've never met a person that doesn't have a baseboard, and I certainly have a very large baseboard. But I think what Zazen helps us do is maybe at best, it just, as we're plugging into it, we kind of go, oh, click, and we just have that moment of, oh, there it is again, click. Maybe sometimes we kind of see it and kind of maybe don't always get all the way there to plug into it. But it's a practice, and it's endless. And so there's all these different things that arise, these Dharma gates, I guess, that you can... It's an opportunity rather than maybe a threat. You can see it as an opportunity to practice with it. So a little bit about how I've... practice with this. I've had in my short life, I'm only 30 years old, and in this short life that I've had the opportunity to see an entire long-term marriage from birth to death. And so I met a girl in my freshman year of college, and we found practice together. And it was really interesting to practice with someone that was also practicing, or to live with someone that was also practicing, and being able to kind of, in little ways, see our own stories and help each other see our own stories. Because I think there's not very many situations where our own stories come up as when we're trying to live with somebody else. Stories about our childhood, about how our parents raised us, about our ideas of cleanliness, our ideas of what's good for dinner, how much TV we should, you know, there's endless stories. But a couple of points that along the way, one really interesting thing I found was as I was practicing with the relationship, and when I would cook, I wasn't very good at it, and I hadn't done a lot of it, and she would kind of hover over me and help me to cook. And I would get really, really overreactively irritated at this, to the point where we had several fights. Just, you know, stop doing that. I'm making spaghetti. Go away. But much angrier. there was a point where I remember when I was sitting that all of a sudden it popped into my head. When I was young, my stepfather grounded me for 2 weeks because I didn't clean my plate. And that's why I'm annoyed at Mickey for telling me to cook spaghetti a certain way. And it was a really kind of really big realization for me. And it came through Zazen. It came through kind of sitting with my own stuff. And the irritation didn't go away, but it had less power after that. Because when, right before I plugged into that switchboard, right before I put that quarter-inch jack in there, I can now see, at least with that one particular problem among millions, that, wow, I'm only irritated at her because my stepdad, 10 years ago, grounded me for 2 weeks for not cleaning my plate. And it was a really powerful moment for me. So that was one idea. And again, though, that's not a life crisis, getting irritated at your wife because she doesn't like the way you cook. That's not a life crisis. But I did have the luxury of going through a life crisis in a heavy practice situation. We kind of grew apart and decided to get a divorce, and we actually had a really nice, amiable divorce. We were able to really work through it pretty well. But I decided after we got a divorce, I was actually kind of already planning on doing this, but it worked out with my housing situation that I was able to kind of put my stuff in storage and go away to a monastery for a month. This was a really interesting time to do this when I was in quite a lot of pain. And kind of just a little bit, not too much about the monastery, but we would practice pretty heavy from Wednesday to Saturday, and then I can't remember what it's called, but they kind of had a weekend on Sunday, and then we would start practicing or sitting again on Monday night. So on the weekends, they had a computer that worked about every 10th time you turned it on, and they had a phone so you could kind of sort of check your email and make some phone calls. And I think it was the second week I was there, I called Mickey up, and she said, I'm dating somebody else. And, oh man, that was just, you know, I'm here, I'm trying to be this enlightened Buddha, and she just stabbed me in the heart. So, now what was interesting was that what happened the next 3 days. At first, I kind of plugged into my story, and I kind of wandered around. We actually were able to watch movies on Sundays. I tried to put in a movie and watch it, and I was so kind of, really what it was is I was so in touch with my emotions that they weren't allowing me to do anything else, which is actually, from a Buddhist perspective, kind of a good thing, but it's incredibly painful. So after that, I kind of gave up and I said, okay, well, I'm here, so what can I do with this? And I just kept asking myself, what is real right now? Because I had a lot of stories going through my head and different things, past histories, but I was able to stay practicing enough to keep saying, and I think this is a really good question. Right now, I mean, at any time, but especially in those times, what is real right now? What is actually happening? What is my true self right now? That's not my story, and it's not my... And I don't think the answer that I found was really all that important. I think the question is really important. But I was able to stay with that, and what I found was there was just this pain in my stomach. Really, really physical pain. And I come to find out that Joko Beck says, and such experiencing is physical. It has nothing to do with the thoughts going on. So, or to walk the razor's edge is to do that. We have once again to be what we basically are, which is seeing, touching, hearing, smelling. She doesn't say anything in there. She doesn't, some other teachers have, but she doesn't say anything in there about thinking. And I do think I've come later on to maybe think that, I mean, obviously that's what's happening in the moment. But at that time, it was all about the physical sensation in my body. And it kind of, after staying with that for a while, it kind of gave me a release. And I was able to come out of it with a way to work with it, a process, a practice. So whenever I could see that coming up, I was able to see it for what it was. And I think that was, I don't know that I could have done that if I had been at home and, you know, had beer available and TV and whatever. But because of where I was, I think it was a really good thing. So that's my experience with walking the razor's edge. And I wanted to end, before I ask your experiences, with, I found this really good book a couple years ago by a Zen master named Ryokan, some Zen poems. And Ryokan is one of my heroes. He is kind of this childlike, ideal Zen master. He lived in a hut by himself, supposedly with just a bowl and a robe, and he went begging every day. But he would go into town and play stickball with the kids, and he was a master calligrapher, and he used to just sometimes he would do some calligraphy for food or whatever. But I came across this this poem he wrote called My Precepts, and I think this is a really good example of someone who's much further down the road than me. He was 80, you know, ish when he died. Talking about how he practices with his own identity. And it starts out with take care not to, which I think is a really cool way to start out a thing talking about the precepts. It's not don't do this, it's take care not to. It kind of brings about maybe a little bit of a smile as you're doing it. But he says, take care not to. And this is written in 18th century. Talk too much, talk too fast, talk without being asked to, talk gratuitously, talk with your hands, talk about worldly affairs, talk back rudely, argue, smile condescendingly at others' words, use elegant expressions, boast, avoid speaking directly, speak with a knowing air, jump from topic to topic, use fancy words, speak of past events that cannot be changed, speak like a pedant, avoid direct questions, speak ill of others, speak grandly of enlightenment, carry on while drunk, he didn't say don't get drunk, he said carry on while drunk, speak in an obnoxious manner, yell at children, make up fantastic stories, speak while angry, name drop, ignore the people to whom you are speaking, speak sanctimoniously of gods and Buddhas, use sugary speech, use flattering speech, speak of things which you have no knowledge, monopolize the conversation, talk about others behind their backs, speak with conceit, badmouth others, chant prayers ostentatiously, complain about the amount of alms, give long-winded sermons, speak affectedly like an artist, speak affectedly like a tea master. So I think that's like 60, 70 years of practice right there, of his practice of kind of just shedding this light on his own suffering and his own identities. So I guess I kind of wanted to open it up at this point. And I don't know, are we doing okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And if you guys have any examples of how you work with your own identities, or I'm up for pragmatic things, I'm up for I don't know, I'm up for whatever you guys have.
Thank you, Josh. So I'm looking for a job. I think I'm the only one, right? And I went to a job fair today, and there is a sea of people, and you have this feeling of, you know, one against a thousand. And it's just the very thought of that one against a thousand, I think is really revealing for me. It's like I have this competition already set up in my mind that I have to be better than a thousand people or else I won't be able to eat. I don't know if there's a solution in that, but it's definitely something that I've been feeling in the past couple of days where it's dawning on me that I have this competition in my mind and I have to be better than others, if that makes any sense. It's a good talk, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think, again, it's just about noticing that and the fact that you are noticing and working with it is enough, I think. I noticed one of my identities as I began giving this talk was welling up and creating a lot of fear. And I think that's kind of what we all go through is... Really, when we kind of get caught up in our own identities, then it creates that almost sometimes disabling fear. But I think it is enough just to look at it.
Thanks for a really good talk.
Thanks.
And some words from one of my favorite Zen books. And I love how she talks about the base board. What I was struck by with something that she was saying and also your experience is how there are times in life where, you know, we can work on sort of breaking down our defenses or reducing them. And then there are some life experiences that just completely... render our defenses useless. And it sounds like that was a that kind of life experience that you were describing. And I've come to the conclusion after listening to many people's versions of that kind of life experience that that's we're lucky if we have those experiences. But I don't mean to minimize how excruciating they are. You know, it's like I reserve the right to complain bitterly when they're happening to me. And I really feel for people when they're happening to them, and I don't want to say, you know, oh, you're so lucky, but because it really does require us in whether we're practicing Buddhism or not, there's something about those life experiences that I feel like really requires us to draw upon something that we didn't have before and become something that we didn't have before. And I guess, you know, for some people, that really brings people to practice and keeps us here. It's that experience of having to draw on something that we didn't have before to manage something that blows everything we previously knew out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
But it sure is awful when it's happening and you just don't know how you're gonna get through it.
Yeah.
But and yet I think that's what happens if you're living a good life. You know, that's the optimal. So.
Well, and if I may, one thing that I kind of a metaphor, I don't know if I thought of when I was going through this experience was my emotion as kind of an energy that pushes this wheel forward. And there's a couple things you can do with that. Once the wheel is going, you can kind of get caught up in that cycle, and it's almost like you keep spinning it. Or you can kind of stick a wrench into it and the wheels, but there's still that energy there and eventually it's going to break through it. Or ideally, like Shakyamuni, if you can just push it, it goes and then kind of stops on its own. So.
Another way using that image that you just did is not that it necessarily stops, but as you were describing before, the physical aspect of it, of physically meeting the situation, mm-hmm. the problem, seeing that wheel, and breathing into it and at least slowing it down enough so that you can see your pain more fully and you can be with the situation, and not to fix it, but to be able to meet yourself.
So there are some things where the wheel's just going to keep going.
Sometimes the wheel keeps going, sometimes you can stop it, but slow, but at least being able to be with it so that it's not carrying you forward in a way that, you know, that you can't be present with it. You can slow it down a little bit sometimes. Serena, you had your hand.
That was a really helpful discussion topic. Thank you. It really made me think about different situations that I've experienced, and I feel like one of them also being divorce and, you know, other difficulties, but somehow experiencing that really intense pain is, it's really difficult, but then sometimes it's very purifying in a way to get to that place of just knowing that there's no action that you can actually do that will change the situation, and there's absolutely nothing to do, and to give up any idea of affecting an outcome, and totally allowing, you know, for me to allow myself to just completely be powerless in the situation and just wait and see what happens, and know that it doesn't have anything to do with me in the end, although, you know, I get to feel the intense emotions, but I've always felt like in those situations, it is, like, I hate to say it, it's been some character building, but I'm so appreciative afterwards, and it feels like I cannot get scarred that way again because of the practice of sitting with it and actually having that awareness to it. It doesn't actually, the pain gets metabolized, it gets worked through, it doesn't linger, it doesn't come back. And so I really am grateful for those experiences, even now, so.
Sometimes we say it's good for your practice.
That's the last thing you want to hear.
So I was thinking as you were speaking too, that would be the King's speech. You know, this sort of how we kind of practice with each other in these intimate ways. You know, of being like, I want to thank you for sharing something very intimate and personal and deep about dealing with the kind of pain of, you know, these identities you have, like this is a marriage and this is the way it works, and, you know, that slips through your hands. Mm-hmm. But also that there was something where, you know, you went to Buddha to get some help and then you get a phone call and can't escape it.
Yeah.
But you know, that these experiences of holding on to certain things, you know, that's my trend. You know, there's an aggressive energy. There's a difference, like, oh, I'd like to be on that train, as opposed to, you know, that grasping reflux. And or I have these limitations, and I'm ashamed of them, so I won't talk about them. I won't really be in touch with what my experience is. And so, you know, I think you're really speaking to something very profound and universal, Josh. So thank you very much for encouraging us in that practice.
Yes. David?
Thanks for the talk. Mm-hmm. And the takeaway that I'm getting from it, which you said and Tigran just mentioned it, was this different way of approaching problems, where you know, my mind will go chatter, 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 chatter. Instead of just staying with the physical sensations of it. I happened to read a book not too long ago on depression and meditation. And it's the exact same approach. Mm-hmm. And it's so different. Maybe because I spend so much time up here, you know, but it's just so different. And yet it seems to subtly undo the knots. Mm-hmm. And I forget it all the time.
Yeah, we know.
But it's really helpful and effective in that same time. And this seems related. I don't know exactly how, but I had an acquaintance who was from rural Africa, and just to watch this guy walk, like he was so centered in his body. And I can't help but think, oh, that must be what it's like to live more, you know, in your body, instead of kind of Western from the neck up, you know. So, thank you.
I failed to mention, I also had this time, it was about 4 months, where I absolutely couldn't sit. It was impossible. I couldn't get on the mat. And I found bicycling. And I actually wasn't really a bicycler, and before now I'm kind of an avid bicycler, but there was something about, again, that physical, some of it was just making myself so tired that I couldn't think about it anymore. I agree to that. But there was something about just the physicalness for me that was really helpful.
I want to say thanks. A really wonderful talk. And what was the name of the middle of the book?
Oh, sorry. So this is also Joe Quebec. Nothing Special, Living Zen. These are the good books.
So I like the image of the plugging in. I certainly do that all the time. But I guess what I wanted to say is that I definitely noticed the feelings I have and like my physical sensations and like kind of what kind of feeling I'm associating and those with. So I'll feel, say, even in fact today earlier, a certain piece of mail came and just, you know, opened it and was like, duh. You know, I just had that feeling, but it was all, it's like, no, not again. And then not again, not, and it wasn't even, had nothing to do with the mail, it was that feeling of having to deal with going through all the emotions of having to get through that, all the knowing what I was going to have to go through to get out of that pain. And so, but I noticed, what I've noticed lately is that those sensations that I have, when I notice them, it's always for the, kind of my, not negative, but my harder times, like when I'm sad or upset or anxious or angry or whatever, I'm not noticing, like, oh, I'm having a great time, I feel, like, because I do notice them, but not that often, you know, and I don't make a point of, like, woo, I can't wait to get through this, you know, this feeling, you know, or, you know, it's such an odd thing, so I'm glad that I'm noticing that lately, so that's something I've actually been sitting with, because I have noticed that so much lately, that really I'm focusing on the physical sensation of kind of these harder feelings of, or these feelings of, you know, just kind of, say dread, but, you know, just kind of harder feelings that I'm having, so, but so that I think is really helpful. I like that. But, you know, just kind of those different things. So thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thanks.
The teacher at the monastery used to say, no one comes to Zen because of rainbows and sunsets.
I wish that was so. I can sit with happiness too, though.
You can, but yeah.
But yeah,
you don't really need help with that. It's pretty, it seems easier, I think.
Yeah,
to be with that.
Well, thank you, Josh, for really a very, very helpful talk. These situations of losing a relationship, losing a job, some sudden illness, or, you know, these situations where suddenly our life is in front of us and it's not what we thought it was, or it has to do with everything, and how we actually can benefit from Zazen and from being present with it in the way you describe. So anyway, thank you for a very helpful talk. Okay.